Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And welcome to TMR 320 for our 20th movie roundtable, where we explore various productions that sometimes connect to themes we've tackled on The Mind Renewed over the last 12 years or so. And today we are diving headfirst into the movie Duel, Steven Spielberg's gripping 1971 suspense thriller, originally a TV movie, but later expanded for theatrical release. And Duel, if just by chance you've not seen it, is a lean, intense tale of a lone motorist hunted by a monster of a truck on the California highways. A masterclass, I would say, in minimalism and tension. And joining us to discuss this cinematic gem are our good friends Frank Johnson from the world capital of nude swimming in California, Mark Campbell from Mastermind headquarters in Crayford in the UK, and Anthony Rotuno carrying out police surveillance at 11 Rollington Place. Gentlemen, welcome back to the roundtable.
Thank you.
Hello again.
Thank you, Julian.
Sorry for my bad jokes there, but I've always got to get them in. You know, it's a bit of a tradition by now. You have to do it. I'm just hoping that things are going to stay stable here because I've got quite a new setup, a new microphone, and two computers joined together, new communication software, etc. So let's hope it all works. So let's start with a bit of a catch-up then. So, Anthony, how's life treating you at the moment? How are you getting on?
Yeah, I haven't really got any exciting news, to be honest. Just truck. Oh. I was going to say trucking along, so I didn't mean that. I honestly didn't.
Yeah. Join in with mine.
No, I do find, I must say, obviously if you follow the news, you find the world's just getting madder. And yeah, I start to feel a bit saner in a way.
By contrast.
That's all I can offer you.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to this film, definitely.
Excellent. Frank, how are you doing over there in California? How's your cat, psychotic cat, getting on?
California's fine. The cat, he now has taken to sitting with me in the middle of whenever I eat and trying to hope for some scraps, I guess.
Yep.
He's still like beating me up occasionally. He's sleeping right now over in the chair, but yeah.
He beats you up. That's a curious thing.
He does, yeah. If I walk by, he'll rub on my leg and then he'll attack my foot and bite it. I guess he's just a bully.
My grandfather had one like that. It would attack him on the stairs through the banisters. So it's quite familiar.
Of course.
To me. Mark, how are you doing? Any
fine, thanks.
Bargain DVDs that you've come across recently?
I did buy a Louis Buñuel boxed set of, I think, like 12 films for about £8 or something in a shop. Unfortunately, it's not got the one I wanted, which was right. Exterminating Angel, but never mind. No. Never mind. Yeah. But I'm fine, thank you. Yep.
And Oscar and her indoors, all okay?
Her indoors is fine. Oscar's fine. We have both watched this film together, so possibly later on we might have his comments on it.
Ah, excellent. That will be really good. Mm. Okay. Mm. Well, let's share a little bit of personal experience with this film then. I'm sure everybody has their tale to tell about this one because it's not exactly obscure, is it? Well, I saw this, I think, back in late 70s with my dad. He absolutely loved it, I remember. He sort of got so wrapped up in it that he thought it was... Well, he knew it wasn't real, you know what I mean? But he had that sense of being so wrapped up that it felt real to him. And he was kind of engaging with the main character, David Mann. And when the lorry was... Oh, sorry, I'm very British, aren't I? Well, the lorry, the truck, was being monstrous on the road. My dad was going, oh, what about that driving? How terrible. How can anybody drive like that, you know? So, yeah, I never tire of watching it, and I have a great affection for it, partly because of that. Mm. Anybody else got any experience to share about this film?
I was wondering if it was it a movie drama one or not? I don't know if, Frank, you're familiar with this, but there was a series that... Basically, they showed kind of cult films every Sunday, and then they had a guy called Alan Cox who would introduce them. I always give it credit for just totally expanding my appreciation of film. I don't know if this was a movie drone, but I feel like it would kind of fit.
Mm.
And it's a strange one because it's technically a limited setting film.
Mm.
Limited setting, you normally think of happening in one room or something.
Yeah.
But because the highway, unless you know it, is fairly anonymous, I suppose it's a limited setting. So it's,
mm.
I don't remember exactly when... first time, but definitely teenage years, and just always liked it.
Yeah.
One thing I did want to talk about a bit later is a kinship with Jaws. I think most of us have seen it. Sorry. referring to that.
Okay, well, all right, I'm going to have to admit, okay, while we were off air, I actually admitted that I've not seen it. So there you go. I know it's unbelievable that there's somebody in the world who's not seen Jaws, but I am one of those people. There we are.
Now, all I was going to say was that I'd already seen Jaws a lot by the time I saw this. So when I saw this, I thought, oh, this is Jaws with a truck. But then, of course, 4 years earlier. So technically, Jaws is this with a shark.
Yeah.
So whichever way you look at it. But no, I've always liked it, yeah. I quite like those kind of minimalist films.
I've got my diary entry here. Obviously, I have to bring this out, don't I?
Absolutely.
This is 11th of December, 1981. So I think that's when I first saw it. I would have been 14. So watched Duel on ITV. The best TV movie I have ever seen. It is surrealistic and quite meaningfully done. Steve Spielberg. But I mean, if I was watching on ITV, it would be with ad breaks. And it's just, I can't imagine watching this with ad breaks because it would break the tension up, wouldn't it?
Well, that's how it was originally made, to be with ad breaks. Yeah, incredibly.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, yeah.
And do we know if we've seen the 75-minute version? Because I've only ever seen the 90-minute.
I think I must have done, because I was very disappointed several years ago. Saw it on, I think, something like ITV3 or something like that, and obviously had ad breaks, but it had did not have the bus scene with the children.
Oh.
And I was appalled. I thought, oh, have they taken it out in order to fit TV? But of course, I didn't realise at the time that it was originally made for TV, and it didn't have that scene in. There were a number of other bits that it didn't have in. They then extended it, of course, to put it in theatrical release. So maybe I did, in fact, see the TV version.
Oh, so they would have gone back and reshot stuff, would they, to make it longer for the to release it? In the
yeah. Well, it was done over 13 days, and then you needed 3 more days.
Right.
Extra stuff.
I mean, that would have been done at a much later date then, wouldn't it?
That's the thing, wondering that. Because in the thing I saw with Spielberg, he made out that, oh, yeah, they just added 3 days, but you're right.
Like, no, let's clear this up. They did add about 3 days originally while they were making the original TV feature. But then a year or so later, they extended it by about 15 minutes or so to make it a theatrical release at 90 minutes. Actually, it's about 85 minutes. But for the European market... So they therefore added the bus scene with the children and the lorry pushing the car towards the train. They added that as well. I think, I'm not sure, but they might even have added the beginning, you know, with them coming out of the garage. I don't know. No doubt somebody will correct me about that. But they added various bits and pieces.
I think the phone call with the wife was added as well, because that's quite an interesting detail.
That's right, because the actress wasn't in the TV version.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've covered quite a bit there already, haven't we? No doubt we'll come back to some of those things. I thought I'd give a quick plot summary for the three people out there in the audience who've not actually seen this. So this really is very, very short, okay, by my standards. So here we go. In Steven Spielberg's Duel, 1971, David Mann, a mild-mannered salesman played by Dennis Weaver, drives his red Plymouth Valiant through the California desert after overtaking a rusty, menacing tanker truck. Or lorry, as I keep saying, its unseen driver, or largely unseen driver, begins an inexplicable, relentless pursuit, turning man's routine trip into a harrowing fight for survival. The psychotic truck tailgates him, cuts him off, rams his car, and does everything it can to escalate this psychological duel. By and by, increasingly frantic, man attempts to identify the insane driver at a roadside diner called Chuck's Cafe, but the faceless antagonist remains deliberately elusive, continuing to heighten the terror. Eventually, the chase having intensified to the point of existential crisis, man uses his wits to lure the truck into a cliffside crash, in which the huge beast of a truck seems to die the death of a giant monster, and the film ends as man, battered but alive, literally jumps for joy like a child as he stares at the wreckage beneath him and sits in silence as the sun sets. No doubt that will have brought the scenes back to people's minds in many, many cases. So, obviously, this is Steven Spielberg at a very young age, 24, I believe, and his first major production, as we said, made for TV initially, 1971, by Universal Television for ABC's Movie of the Week, which they had in the late 60s and early 70s. And then it was made, 73 or 72 for Europe and extended to 90 minutes. It's usually listed as his first feature film, although he did do some things earlier on.
So it's Sugarland Express, wasn't that first? Sugarland Express, or was that afterwards?
74, so that was a bit later.
Okay.
Yeah. He did an episode of Night Gallery also. That was a TV show, though.
Right.
Did a lot of Columbo as well.
He did one. I know of one. He might have done more, but Murder by the Book in 71.
Because he won an award, I think.
Uh-huh. Has anybody seen The Name of the Game? It was another TV series. He did one episode for that called LA 2017. So it seems that by doing these TV programs, that gave him an in with the producer of Duel, because this was already a project and they were looking for somebody to direct it. And he applied for it because his secretary said, hey, you might like this project. So she came across Richard Matheson's story in Playboy magazine, apparently, and presented it and said, look, this is a story you might want to go for. And he liked it and applied to George Eckstein, not Erickson, Eckstein, said, look, I've done Columbo, things like that. And he was impressed and gave him the job. So sometimes doing things like Columbo can get you ahead, which is an interesting thought.
I think he learned about economy, didn't he, from TV, I suppose. Mm. Imagine the TV deadlines are pretty brutal.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Because obviously the deadlines, this was very close. So.
Yeah, very much so.
And I have read the short story. It is very short, 25 pages or something. Uh-huh. So essentially, it's just the thrust of the film. It hasn't got things like the things they added for the cinema. It hasn't got his talking with his wife and the argument. And it's basically starts out in the first page, overtakes the truck, and then it just, you know, from there on, it hasn't got pushing the truck onto the train lines and stuff. It's a bit bizarre because he gives the truck driver a name, Keller.
Yes.
On the side of the van, because the David Mann character, you know, Mann, M-A-N-N, he reads it first as Killer, and then he looks again, oh, no, it's Keller.
Right.
And then then the character himself says, well, that seems to make the mystery a bit less, giving him a name, which is a bit odd. So you don't get that in the film, do you? You don't know what he's called.
No.
He's going towards San Francisco for an appointment. Is he going to San Francisco in the film? Is that mentioned? I can't remember.
No, I don't remember. No.
The story, I mean, the difference is he's driving through lush forests and the greenery in the story. I mean, obviously the film's quite different. The one thing that I noticed was very different was the ending of the story, because it just ends with man going up this sort of side road up towards a quarry, which is a bit like in the film. And then behind him, the truck takes the corner, I guess too sharply, tips over and just falls into the quarry. So actually, man has got nothing to do with the end. He's just, it's a really weird ending. Huh. It's considerably better in the film that man is actually takes control at last of the situation.
He wins the duel effectively, doesn't he? For those people who don't know it, he puts his briefcase, doesn't he, down on the gas pedal. And then jumps out of the car, and the truck carries on and pushes the car and itself over the cliff.
So he
wins the duel, but he doesn't in the novelette.
The truck driver just loses control and crashes, you know, and the end.
Okay.
It's almost like Mashin says, I can't be bothered to write anymore.
Was it a red... Sorry.
That's interesting, because I don't want to hammer this Jaws thing, but in the Jaws novel, the shark kills two of the Quint and Hooper, and then basically he's about to attack Brody and then just sort of gets tired. He's worn down by all the barrels and the harpoon and everything, and he just dies. It's a complete damn squib. And obviously in the film, don't want to spoil it for you, Julian, if you watch it.
Okay, I will watch it one day.
It's a bit more explosive.
I think I said I might watch them in reverse order, start with Jaws the Revenge or whatever it is, and then go to 3D and then Jaws 2 and then eventually work back to the original Spielberg film. That's perverse of me, I know, but there we are.
Matheson got the inspiration because he was tailgated on November the 22nd, 1963. Do you feel like that might not have been the biggest news story that day? I'm not making light of it. I'm just saying that.
I read the same thing. You're right. He on that day, he did, yeah.
Isn't that weird?
That is weird,
There's the connection with our themes on the show. How about that?
Was he tailgated in Dealey Plaza or was it somewhere else?
Oh, they'd been playing golf or something, hadn't they?
Yeah.
And they were talking about this, and then this person tailgated them,
They heard the news and they're a bit shaken. They said, let's forget the golf then and we'll go home.
And then he tried to get people, I think he tried to get TV companies or something interested in it, and they thought, well, there's just not enough here for a production. You know, get chased across the desert by a lorry, you know. Well, okay.
That's kind of weird that they would kind of, I find that a little weird they would reject that, because I think he had written a number of stories that ended up on the Twilight Zone, you know?
That's right.
Like Nightmare at 20,000 Feet or whatever, that had William Shatner in it. He wrote that story, I believe, and then he's written several others, were on there.
That's right. Yeah, something like 16 of them, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
A lot of other things.
Yeah.
He actually also wrote Jaws 3D. I'm not making this up.
How is that?
Are you kidding?
He wrote Shrinking Man, which was made into The Incredible.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
It's great. That's a great book. And that's not too long either, is it?
That's good.
Yeah.
In preparing to talk about this film, I had looked up what was any symbolism in this movie. Mm-hmm. And they say that the perception of masculinity was one of the themes, because at the beginning, you know, the guy on the radio talking about being a house husband, right? Mm-hmm. And so he's taking on a traditionally female role. And then you see man having some problems with his wife. And when you brought up the Shrinking Man, too, that whole story was also about the man is shrinking. It's symbolic of masculinity is shrinking and becoming less of a influence or less powerful. So, so I couldn't help but notice that that was possibly a theme that Matheson must like working with or exploring. I don't know if that came across in the written story.
Yeah, it's not so much. It's essentially plays.
So that's
the same,
more in the film.
Yeah, the story. He's similar character. He doesn't like driving fast, and he's a bit scared by the other driver. And so it's all that similar, but not to the extent that the film takes it.
Gotcha.
Right,
Julian. Would you mind if I just read my short paragraph about this?
Just 1 second. I just wanted to say that I'd not picked that business about the masculinity up from what Spielberg had said himself.
Yeah,
I picked it up as, you know, other people had interpreted it, and I know that Spielberg said something like he had some views about it, of course, as the director. But he said a lot of the symbolic stuff tends to come from Europe. People interpreting things in Europe. So we're mostly Europeans on this podcast, so we can play around with it as well. But go on. Go on then, Anthony.
Yeah, masculinity and loss of it and gaining control by using inner resources. The everyman is nothing special. And, of course, I guess you all know that the David man is supposed to symbolize an everyman.
Yeah.
The radio phone-in is a house husband. His wife is designated head of the household. Man's wife complains that he did nothing when a man tried to molest her or make a pass at her. He sits in a corner of Chuck's cafe that's pink.
I think colors are
chosen quite deliberately, aren't they? He remarks that he's back in the jungle again, having to rely on primitive instincts.
That's true.
The truckers look tough and primitive, while man is a bit more refined and clearly not much of a fighter. By the end, he's successfully abandoned his inhibitions and fought fire with fire, giddy with excitement at his achievement.
Yeah,
I noticed that pink cafe, but I looked at it and thought, it looks so realistic, unkempt. Looks like he's just gone in and filmed it. I thought, would he have painted it pink? Or it just seemed so that was a sort of pink.
Maybe they just found it, I suppose.
I don't know. It was it fits, doesn't it, so well.
Apparently the Tuck's Diner is still standing too. So
Yes, it's a French restaurant, I think, now, but it's still there. Okay, we'll come back to meanings and things a bit more in a bit. Just wanted to say a few more things, ask you what you think about it. What did you think about the music, by the way? A guy called Billy Goldenberg, who I tend to mix up with Jerry Goldsmith. I don't know why. But yeah, I thought it was quite effective, actually. I can hardly imagine the film with any other music now, of course.
There's not a lot of it, which is good, isn't it? That's the good thing. There's not a lot of it.
That's...
And then when it's very psycho, I mean, immediately I thought, psycho. There's the strings. Very psycho.
A lot of strings.
You know, Jaws or whatever, proto-Jaws. I mean, I don't
remember. It reminded. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I don't remember the music much, which I think is a good thing because it just suits the action.
I feel like I always say that when I'm talking about film. Yeah. Unless it's obviously like Jaws or Rocky or something that's so, or Star Wars or something. Yeah, it does the job, I'd say.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's conceived of as sound rather than music. You know, there's a lot of percussive stuff going on, weird percussive instruments. It reminded me of sort of John Cage and a guy called Harry Parch who made his own instruments. I even wonder whether there's some prepared piano in there at times. Mm. Sounds a bit like the articulation of a piano, but weird percussive sounds, and I wonder whether that's what's going on. Mm. It was written pretty quickly, apparently, and Billy Goldenberg had worked with Spielberg before, but I think it works really well, what he did.
It reminded me very much of another Matheson story that was adapted, which was The Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. I can't remember if it was the film version from Twilight Zone, the movie, or the actual episode with Shatner in it. But I want to say it reminded me of the one with John Lithgow in the movie. Just suspense hits you, just scare the crap out of you music, you know. And I thought it worked really well in this movie. But I was just like, wow, does this same composer do every Matheson adaptation? I don't know who did the music in Twilight Zone, but it really reminded me of that sort of feeling to it, you know, conveying that sense of terror and dread really well.
Right. Yeah. You know, one thing that really sticks in my mind is right at the end, you know, when everything's calm and the truck has died, as it were, you just get that weird sort of repeated, I don't know how to describe it. It's like really high strings. I think it might be synthesized, actually. It's just like a weird chord high up and just goes, it just carries on like that. And it's just perfect.
Because I can't remember it. I was wondering, is there a point where it goes quite fast as the action's going, or is it not that kind of music?
No, there is at times. Oh, definitely, yeah.
Oh, there is. Yeah.
Lots of repeated rhythms.
Yeah, I feel like there was, yeah.
I think it kicks in, doesn't it? Probably not when he overtakes the truck, but when the truck starts coming for him, I think it sort of then kicks in. So probably after about 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, I think you get more and more of it. Yeah,
yeah, and I think also when the truck driver's trying to run him down at the rattlesnake place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, what about the cast then? Dennis Weaver. I think he was the right man for the job. Spielberg was desperate for him to do that part, apparently.
No, he's excellent. I think he's excellent, isn't he?
Yeah,
I think he is. Yeah.
Doesn't he play some cowboy detective?
McLeod.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen it, but I know him for that.
Oh, I used to watch that as a child.
Yeah, that's all I know him from.
Have you seen Touch of Evil?
No.
Orson Welles, is he in that?
Oh, that's so good. You've got to watch that.
Yeah, it's amazing, Jude. Another good film.
I've seen the clip. I thought, I've got to see that clip if that was so important to Spielberg that he thought that's the guy I need. So I did see Weaver doing that.
Because the original idea was that the tension would build that he'd end up like that at the end of the film, but he doesn't quite get there.
No.
Because that Touch of Evil scene is unbelievable. I mean, I've never seen anyone that nervous, you know. He didn't quite get there, but it was obviously Spielberg knew that it was there if he needed it. You know, I'm sure he could have conjured it up 10 years later.
I wonder whether he was influenced by McLeod as well, because you've got the, you know, that sense of the cowboy in New York City, naive but not naive at the same time sort of thing. A man out of his comfort zone, in his comfort zone, and then suddenly out of his comfort zone. I wonder whether there was some sort of influence there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree. I thought it was brilliant, yeah.
I thought it was an interesting callback to an earlier film we'd done, The Appointment, it's this not dissimilar individual in a way, perhaps you could say, this sort of symbol of masculinity. Mm. Certainly he's kind of like exhibits a kind of cowardly side, doesn't he, in Dennis Weaver in this film. And he's going to the appointment, and of course something happens on the road to the appointment, you know.
Mm. Yeah, The Appointment had a phone booth scene as well, didn't it?
Yeah.
I think I mentioned Jewel when we did The Appointment, so yeah, may as well mention it the other way around as well.
Which he did himself, apparently, that phone booth scene.
Yeah, I love that.
It was just timed so that he could get out safely before the truck hit it. That was well done.
Yeah, yeah. Something that struck me watching this, I think perhaps I take it for granted. There are no special effects. By that, I mean there's no blue screen or green screen or anything. It is all done in camera. Everything you see is happening. And there's tons of stuff of him. It's clearly him driving the car, isn't it, Dennis Weaver?
Most of the time it is.
I mean, there must be some shots with a stunt double, but
he's
going at quite some speed, you know, and the truck's behind him, and they're obviously cutting it together to make it look more dangerous than it is. But I think it's so impressive that it's all being done for real.
Yeah.
You know?
They had several cameras as well, didn't they, around that car? Because you get back shots of him front and side, and then one on the bonnet looking through the windscreen.
Yeah,
and,
And there's a brilliant shot with the camera, obviously, isn't it? The car going past him, I think, and then it goes past him and then goes past the truck in front of him. And it's just, it's so fluid. You know, the camera work in the film is incredible.
It is.
There's almost no still shots. It's all moving, and it's fantastic.
Yeah. And apparently the production manager thought that that couldn't be done. Right. He wanted it to be in studio. And Spielberg had to fight to say, no, I want to do this outside. And they gave him the benefit of the doubt, and that's why he had three extra days stuck on at the end. But yeah, they were going to stick it in the studio, which would have been a disaster, wouldn't it?
Oh. Imagine the driving in a fake background. Taking you out of the film.
I mean, everyone was doing it. Obviously, Hitchcock did it all the time in his films. So to not do it at all is really impressive.
Yeah. And the phone booth thing was good, because what they did, they set up flags or something. And when the stunt driver was driving the truck, if Dennis Weaver hadn't left the phone booth by the time he reached the last flag, then he was going to just veer off So, right. And I think the stunt driver was amazing, apparently. So I, wow. I don't, you know, there's still an element of danger, but
oh, absolutely,
you know, it's taken for granted.
Oh, a big element of danger. I wouldn't have wanted to do that.
You earned his money. Yes.
For all the cowardice, I'm not sure about the actual man himself, Dennis Weaver. Yeah, yeah, that stunt driver was top in his class. A guy called Kerry Loftin did loads and loads of stuff, apparently. Great technician as well. Bullet, French Connection, Smokey and the Bandit, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
He had lots of different names professionally. So he was William Kerry Loftin. He was Kerry Loftin, Carrie Loftin, Kerry Lofton, Gary Loftin. I don't know why he had so many names, but there we are. And Spielberg said to him, I want somebody who is a mean SOB. And apparently Kerry Loftin said, well, you've chosen the right guy then.
I heard that same story a little different. I was just going to say it.
Okay.
The story I read, he asked Spielberg why the truck driver would do this to this guy. And he's like, well, you're just a mean SOB.
right.
I like your version a little better, actually.
I don't know which is true. Something along those lines happened.
Yeah, with the driving, they used the camera car that was used in Bullet, didn't they? They had low angles, long lenses, and then they had the cliffs going by, and it's all brilliant. It gives the illusion that it's much faster than it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
They said there's an art, for stunt drivers, there's an art to driving at a safe speed, but making it look like, you know, this is a, I don't know, obviously there's camera tricks as well. But
yeah, they must have gone at some speed at times, because the composer, Billy Goldenberg, was... Spielberg wanted him in the seat of the truck just to experience what it was like. And apparently he was freaked out initially. So it must have been pretty hairy at times.
Oh, wow.
No, it's nothing like French Connection. I won't go into it now, but if you like French Connection, you should look into how they did that car chase.
Has anyone seen a film called Unhinged with Russell Crowe?
No.
No.
Because it's sort of similar premise. It's 2020. It's about a woman taking, I think, her child to school. And there's a truck. I think it's just a great big Jeep at the lights, and she just beeps it to say move on. And from that moment on, the truck is out to get her. Russell Crowe is out to get her. So it's kind of like a really, really violent, really stupid, because it just goes off into ridiculous. It just, you think, what, really? So it's like they take somebody's seen Duel and gone, let's do this times 100. But the premise is similar. I recommend it. It's good fun. It's great fun. If you like Russell Crowe, it's great. He just plays an out-and-out nasty SOB.
I was going to ask, Mark, when you read the story, was there a red car in it?
Oh, I can't remember.
Oh, okay. Spielberg wanted a red car. He wasn't bothered that it should be a Plymouth Valiant, but he wanted a red car against the scenery to be picked out easily.
Fair enough.
And what about the truck? Was that specified, or was that another decision that Spielberg made?
It's a truck and a trailer. It said, I've got it here. I should be able to search, shouldn't I?
We talk about the casting of the truck in a minute, Judy, because that's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a nice idea, isn't it? There aren't that many. Yeah, quite. There's not much cast to talk about. We have to talk about the vehicles instead.
Yeah, because the way it was cast was brilliant.
I've got, okay, so he eyed the truck with cursory disapproval. It was a huge gasoline tanker pulling a tank trailer, each of them having six pairs of wheels. He could see that it was not a new rig, but was dented and in need of renovation. Its tanks painted a cheap-looking silvery colour. Man wondered if the driver had done the painting himself. He's got the flammable thing. That was in the film, isn't it? Flammable on the back, I think, yes. Which I guess you need for the ending because it, you know, explodes, doesn't it?
No, the lorry doesn't explode.
Doesn't it?
The film doesn't explode, no.
No, the car does.
Oh, okay.
I think
the car blows up.
I had read that Spielberg had changed it because he didn't want it to explode at the end, because I think time it must have already been overdone or whatever.
Oh, okay.
In the written story, I believe it does explode.
Yeah.
Technically, it's a mistake because they had the flammable thing and they'd already been filming some of it before they'd maybe worked the ending out.
Possibly.
Well, I had read that someone suggested that the reason it didn't explode is because the tanker was empty. And so that's why he could go so fast through the movie, is his tanker was never full. Which makes you wonder, like, he had either just dropped something off, was going to go pick something up, or maybe he just was had been out of work for so long, and that's why he's mad. That was actually another symbolic thing somebody picked up on. It's funny, but, like, someone had picked up that maybe, you know, it's like it's symbolically it's some sort of... like, he's just taking revenge on some guy who's got it better than him. You know, he's down on his luck truck or whatever.
Right. Yeah, I like the idea that he's been out of work for some time, because that might explain why he's got six number plates at the front of the lorry?
Yeah.
Suggesting that he's had six previous victims on the road.
Yeah, he's like a serial killer, isn't he? And they're all different states as well.
Yes.
I like that idea, and that's the first thing I thought of when I saw that opening shot or whatever. But yeah. I was looking that up, too, because I'm like, why was there six license plates? Supposedly, at the time this was filmed, if you were a trucker and you were operating interstate here in the U.S., you had to have a license plate for each state that you were working in. Whereas now, it's like you just have one plate and you're good for wherever. But like back then when they filmed this show, that was the thing. Unfortunately, I don't know if this is true, but this is what I read online. That was just how it was back then and not other victims. I do really like the idea of other victims because I thought about that.
I love that. Like, right.
So that must just be a European interpretation.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, I thought that too until I looked it up. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, okay.
I guess the decision.
I think it's a natural interpretation of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the decision not to have it blow up, as far as the film is concerned, is to accentuate the idea that it's a monster dying, and you can have all that business of the crashing down the side, and then you have the dripping oil and all this, don't you? Whereas if it was all blowing up, then it would take away from that, I think.
Mm-hmm. You know the thing about the sound as it's dying, as the truck's quote-unquote dying?
I have, but of course, not having seen Jaws, I don't appreciate the significance of it. Go on, tell us about it.
Right, so there's a film called, I think it's called The Land Unknown. I think I've got that right. It's a dinosaur film. It's something like that. And there's a kind of roar or a groan the creature gives just as it's dying. Uh-huh. So Spielberg used that here as the truck's going over, and then he used it for the shark as well.
Yes.
And he also used another thing as well. There was a thing where he had six cameras set up, I think, but one actually captured the whole death, quote unquote. And there's a bit where you see a load of dust and then the truck reemerges out of the dust. And again, he copied that in Jaws. You see the sharks disappear, then you see like a blood and then the fin comes back. So Spielberg, he's into that kind of thing, isn't he?
He is, absolutely. He likes these links between his films. I was going to say there's a link with some of the cast, actually. Did anybody pick up on the elderly couple in the film?
They're in Close Encounters.
They are.
Ah, with In Close Encounters. Right.
Yep, so in Close Encounters, they are implantee number one and implantee number two in the helicopter scene.
Okay.
Wow. So that's Amy Douglas and Alexander Lockwood, the old couple in the car.
So as a couple, so they feature again as a couple?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So it's like an in-universe couple. That links Jewel with Close Encounters in the same universe. Wow.
That's very weird, isn't it?
We just talk about how the truck was cast, Julian.
Yes, absolutely. Gosh, there's so much to talk about, isn't there? I don't know where to go with this. But we can just hop all over the place. Sure, the casting of the truck,
Spielberg talked about it as a casting, so they showed him seven trucks and one seemed to have a face on it.
He immediately said,
you've got the part almost.
He auditioned it.
He talked about having the truck in makeup as well, just as Dennis Weaver was in one room getting made up and the truck was being smeared with grease and bugs and stuff.
Brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant.
That's right. So it was a Peterbilt 281. It was called the Needle Nose as a nickname because it's sort of a retro snout-like face. But when they made the extension to this for the theatrical release, they didn't have exactly the same truck, so they had to modify a different one called a Peterbilt 351. But you don't notice the difference, do you? I didn't notice the difference. I had to find that out.
I didn't.
No.
Somebody will somewhere will notice the difference.
I'm sure.
It's
sure.
Two trucks.
Yes.
They used more than one car, didn't they? I mean, it stands to reason, I guess. So
three or four of them, yeah.
Apparently, if you look at it closely, there will be differences in terms of the damage on the car and stuff.
Yeah, talking about looking at things closely, did anybody see Spielberg's reflection?
I saw him once in the phone booth. I hadn't seen that before.
He's in the back of the car, isn't he?
Yeah, apparently so, yeah.
Which is quite apt because he talked in that interview about Hitchcock being on his shoulder. And of course, Hitchcock had obviously intentional cameos, but that was quite fun. Do you want some real rando trivia?
Well, I was wondering whether we could choose some favourite scenes to talk about. We've been rather general so far. But there are some smashing particular scenes, aren't there? So does anybody want to go first? I mean, okay, I'll go first with the... I just love this. The pest control car. It's just a silly little thing. But I love the fact that he obviously thinks it's a police car. I'll pull over and it's not. It's just pest control. But it's got Greblipes printed on the side.
Greblipes.
Which, of course, I never realised that before until I read it somewhere. Just passed me by. But yeah, of course, it's Spielberg backwards.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I really like the scene that now I realise it wasn't in the original cut with the school bus. It's an odd scene because it's absolutely brilliant because the truck turns out to be a goodie at the end because he helps push, you know, he shows you how much he hates the man character. He's nice to everyone else, so he pushes the school bus, does a good turn for the bus driver.
Don't you think that's gaslighting?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
I do. Yeah,
trying to make man feel like he's going mad almost, you know.
But there's a weird scene, and I don't know if anyone else picked up on it, it was just me. The driver is there with the kids. He's, oh, come and help, help. And he's kind of really urgent, like it's panicked almost to get the school bus moving. And then man is pushing against, and he says, come on, come on. Like it's urgency to get out of it, almost as if he knows there's something scary around. I thought that was a bit odd.
Especially odd since later the children are running around, not actually on the road, but near the road. And man, of course, sees the truck arrive again with its sort of shining cat's eyes in the tunnel. And he's thinking, oh, no, he's... Yes. And there's some bad language, which I noticed they included in the theatrical release there because they felt more able to do so. And he's going, you know, get these children off. And the bus driver's saying, hey, no, they're fine. So that rather contradicts the urgency of before.
It's a bit weird. It's almost like it would make sense if they filmed it after the event. They knew what they've got and they thought, well, we'll try and up the ante by, giving some more tension to it. But I just think it's a really tense scene with the kids milling around. You know, oh, my gosh, what's going to happen?
Yes.
And that's very Jaws-like, having kids being threatened by this, you know, mysterious, massive thing that's uncontrollable, very Jaws-like.
Apparently, there are some people who are of the opinion that these extra bits are sort of slow the action down, even stopping at Chuck's Cafe. It slows it. It should stay on the road. And I don't agree with that at all. I think actually moving from the physical action, the physical tension, to the psychological dimension is actually, does keep the tension going, but in a different way. I think that's very powerful. Yeah.
Yes, I agree.
And I think the inner monologue is supposed to bring us closer to man, I think. Man.
Mm. Yeah, David Mann.
That's taken straight from the short story, actually, that internal monologue. It's pretty much Matheson's lines spoken. Oh,
that's interesting. You see, I wondered whether that was a good idea. I have sometimes wondered, is it really necessary to have that vocalization? You know, couldn't you just do it with acting and looks? And I think maybe not, actually, in the end. There's too much to convey.
I think it works.
I think it works. Yeah.
You could do it visually, but I think it'd be incredibly difficult. And given his tight timetable, he probably couldn't have done it. I mean, like, you could have, like, Sergio Leone or David Lynch. Hold on, somebody's at my door.
That's a very suitable moment for that to happen. You just mentioned David Lynch.
Steven Spielberg's at the time. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I'm sorry. They were checking to make sure I got my screens out. They're doing window cleaning. So I'm sorry.
We'll definitely include that in the show there, Frank.
Oh, that's terrible. Here, look at the cat. He's
Oh no.
He was a little bit freaked out by that. But so you could definitely convey that visually, that tension. And I think, like, if you watch Sergio Leone Western, like, that's he really amps that tension up. But I mean, in 3 days, you really, I don't know you could do that.
I would say it works well for this character because he's a man who is in constant dialogue in his head, isn't he? He's constantly thinking about things and worrying about things and what's going on. Why is he doing that? How can he go so fast? And that kind of makes sense that he would have this internal monologue going on all the time. I think it works really well.
Yeah, and there's more nuance that you wouldn't have been able to include if it was just expressions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although the business about the Western, you know, there are tips, aren't there, towards the spaghetti Western at times, so it wouldn't have been out of character to do that. There's some scenes where it's clearly emulating a duel in a spaghetti Western.
Yeah.
I think Chuck's Cafe is perhaps my favourite bit of the film, actually. I think it's a great scene.
Right.
A collection of scenes, really.
It's not so much a scene, but more like a moment when he falls asleep.
Oh, yeah.
The train.
Yeah.
Spielberg actually used the sound of a truck for the train.
Right.
So the audience is going to think that it's a truck. But the idea was that David Mann
that was brilliant.
Out of a dream.
Yeah.
So maybe he thinks it's the truck. But then he starts laughing. I love that.
It's so believable, isn't it? That's exactly what would happen. Yeah. If you've been so terrified by this truck and you were coming out of that dream, that's what you'd hear, isn't it? It totally makes sense.
Yeah. The idea of laughing about it, I think, is great.
Yes, absolutely.
It's like a moment. Yeah.
Is that the bit where you get lots of fantastic long shots of environment and then right there is the red car in the distance? you can just see the red car framed by the, there's a, like a scrap heap of old cars, and there's his car.
That's the one.
And you get another shot, and you think, oh, there's the red car. It's brilliantly done, really arty.
Old cars from the 40s and things, and rusting in the...
Yeah,
yeah.
Something a little bit disquieting about a scrap heap of old cars, especially in this film, I guess, because that's where he's heading, isn't he? Essentially, he thinks he's going to end up on the scrap heap.
Yeah.
And it is where he ends up.
That's some lovely use of camera work, isn't there? I mean, one thing I really love, you know, where he goes in to phone his wife.
Yeah.
It's a laundrette as well, this place.
Yes.
Puts his foot up on a table or something, and he has to put his foot down because this lady wants to go past with her washing.
Yeah.
And then she goes back to use the washing machine or whatever it is, and she opens the door, and the camera actually shoots through the glass of the door, and you see David Mann on the phone in the background, and all this washing is in the foreground, as if to say life just carries on. He may be terrified by what's going on, but
fishbowl. He's in a fishbowl, isn't he?
That's true as well. Yes,
I love that.
It is a lovely touch.
Totally.
One of the things I love about that Chuck's Cafe scene is when he approaches the guy, you know, actually to challenge somebody who he thinks might be the trucker. Of course, it isn't. The trucker isn't even in there, is he? He's still gaslighting him. The guy's just eating a sandwich and drinking a beer. And David Mann just sidles up to him almost backwards and just says, you know, come on. What does he say? Knock it off or something. And then you get a really low shot.
Yeah, knock it off.
That's it. Yeah. And you get a really low shot of this guy, you know, underneath his chin, and he's just chewing away at this sandwich. That so works. I don't know why that works. Mm. Why is it? Why have such a low camera angle? And he goes, what? What are you talking about?
And there's a funny... Did anyone notice the funny bit in the Chuck's Cafe? He says something like... I want cheese on rye, R-Y-E.
Yes.
Oh, that's it, yeah.
That's it. I mean, what?
Yeah.
It's such a sparse dialogue. Why has he got R-Y-E? What else could it be?
Yes. I suppose it's something odd that somebody might say.
I know.
People do say odd things.
I know. It's funny. I just thought, that's amusing. Why is he saying
it? Is that in the story? Is that in the short story?
No, I don't think it is.
No.
He doesn't spell it out.
Trying to point out the difference, aren't they? I suppose if this was an English film, I reckon they would have really played up the class element, you know.
Ah, yes.
Mm. Had like a real middle class hero among all these truckers, you know. Something like that.
Well, with the inner dialogue thing where he's speaking inside his head, you know, I love the fact that it goes whispered eventually. He's whispering inside his head like that. As if that's, you would be speaking under your breath if you were actually articulating it. I love that. That adds an urgency to it.
I love the opening of it, credits for ages, and it just starts on a black screen and you get the radio. And you think, oh, what's going on here? And after literally 5-6 seconds, then the camera, you're pulling out of this garage, aren't you?
Yes.
And then you're driving, and just like the first 2 or 3 minutes is driving along. It's very classy.
Really classy.
Do you know if that was done for the cinema or...?
I don't know. Mm. I have a feeling it may be for the cinema, but I'm not sure about that.
It sets
you get footsteps at the beginning, don't you?
Yeah, gets in the car, backs out the garage, and off you go.
And you are David Mann, aren't you? Because you have his view through the windscreen for ages.
Yes.
So it establishes that he's every man and you are every man.
Yeah, I love that. It's such a bold, clever opening.
You get so much of the radio show as well. I don't know how long it is, 10 minutes?
And somebody says, somebody's interviewed saying, and they say they play meat.
Yeah, they play meat.
What's that all about? What do you mean you play meat?
Musically, I guess.
Yeah. You know, with a pair of drumsticks or something.
Boom, boom.
Oh, do you know, there's something I hadn't realised until I was thinking about it for this, is the next, you know, after the bus scene, the school bus scene, the next event is the train sequence where the truck is pushing David Mann's car towards the train. Obviously not in order to kill him, because he could have pushed him in, but, you know, it's more terrifying him. That is, in a sense, an opposite of what happened in the scene before, where he was pushing the school bus to help, but now he's pushing David Mann to hinder. I'd not realised that. Yeah. But there we are.
And I don't know how they did that, but that looks incredibly dangerous, doesn't it? I mean, is that the stunt driver then, I guess, was...
Could well be.
There's a real train, there's a real car, there's a real... It's all going on, but it looks amazing. It looks so close.
It does.
I guess they cheat it with angles and it's not really being pushed, obviously, but it's just... There's a real big blimmin' train going past.
That was added, wasn't it? That was another one of these added scenes.
Right, okay. I'm quite a fan of the Incredible Hulk TV series, and there is an episode of the Incredible Hulk that's all about David Banner. I think being chased by, I don't know what it is. Anyway, he falls in with some woman, and they go off country, and they use loads and loads of shots from Duel.
That's right.
But it's brilliant because there are two of them in the car, but they always. The woman says, "I'm just going to go down and get something from the glove compartment." And then you cut to the shot of Dave Mann in the car because, of course, there's only one of him. So they always get around it by having somebody duck out of sight. Then you have a long shot of the car. It must be about 10 minutes of footage from that film in that episode.
Yeah.
They're both Universal, aren't they?
Yeah.
Ever since then, now Spielberg essentially sort of copyrights all his material.
Yeah, he hated that apparently, didn't he? Yeah, I can understand that.
The episode was called "Never Give a Trucker an Easy Ride."
Yes.
What about the sequel?
I didn't know there was one.
Duel 2.
No, it's called Throttle. Anyone seen that?
No,
you're joking. It's
fairly horrendous.
Are you kidding? Is that a real movie?
Yeah, it is a real movie. 2003, I want to say.
What?
But the main character's surname is Weaver.
Okay.
And Dennis Weaver appears. He's in it. I haven't seen it, by the way. They're in a parking lot, and this red, whatever that car, whatever type of car that was, is just going really slowly in the parking lot, and they make eye contact, and Dennis Weaver just sort of eyeballs him for a bit.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's like an
injury. I won't be visiting that one. And there was a board
like make
game.
A sequel.
Well. Yeah, there was a dual.
They need to make a prequel.
Yeah, the troubled childhood of the truck driver.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Wonder what that would involve.
Well, then, Mark, you're a filmmaker.
Okay, I'll go off and do that then.
Yeah, go on.
Did they really make a board game of this movie though? Because
apparently,
I believe so.
A dual board game.
Yeah, apparently it wasn't.
Which was not very popular, I'm told.
Oh wow, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Oh, there's no. I suppose there couldn't really be. There's no shooting star in this film.
Oh yeah, that was a Spielberg thing.
That's a Spielberg thing, yeah. Because none of it's at night, so I guess they couldn't do that.
I suppose there's the sun at the end.
Is that a shooting?
No, it's a star.
It is a Star Wars, I guess.
Half of the theme was included. Oh dear.
What about the truck as a corporation? I'm trying to bring it around to some PMR-style topics.
I was going to say, actually, can we talk about possible meanings and themes? I know we touched on that earlier, but we should talk a little more. And feel free to be as European as you would like. Even you, Frank.
Sure. Maybe the lorry driver was part of the Brotherhood of the Bell. Now they're going to come get revenge on David Mann.
Ah, yes. He betrayed his oath, perhaps, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, I recognise that mop of curly hair.
As Oscar's here, just before he goes to bed,
I
want to ask him what he thought of the film. Like, I'm going to put headphones on him so you can talk to him. Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't know what to do. Uh-huh.
Well, he's just going to talk to you.
Hello, Oscar.
Hello.
Hello, Oscar.
Hello.
Hello. Now, your daddy tells me that you have seen the film Duel with the lorry.
Yes.
And the car.
Yes, we have.
Now, what did you think of it? Did you like the film?
Yes, I really liked a bit where he was chasing after the car.
Did you find it at all scary with that big lorry doing all the chasing?
No, not scary. I found it funny.
Did you? You found it funny? Yeah. I say.
Yeah.
What about at the end when the lorry dies like a big monster at the end? Was that scary?
It's a little bit scary, that bit. It was.
Mm. You thought that he should change the colour of his car, didn't you?
Yeah.
What tell Julian?
He should have changed his colour of the car.
That would have been a good idea.
Which colour?
So that the lorry driver wouldn't recognise it anymore.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. It's good thinking. Very lateral thinking there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Quite impressive.
Yes.
Is enough?
Yeah.
All nice right, to speak to you, Oscar.
Nice to speak to you.
Very good.
Nice to speak to you.
See ya.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Good night.
Well done, Oscar. Very good.
So, Mark, we have all your bank account passcodes now. Now that you've got your headphones back on and you can hear what's going on.
Yeah, no, I couldn't read. Was that all right? Was he all right there?
Yes, he's very good.
Did you give some good?
Yeah, very good.
No, we enjoyed it.
Mm.
I thought, I was worried, it's interesting, actually, because I was worried whether he would find it scary because he doesn't like scenes in films where people get scared of things. He sort of tends to leave the room, but he was okay with that film. He was all right.
Yeah.
Wow.
He kept wanting me to tell him what's going to happen next. What's going to happen next? Mm. Which I guess is a bit of a reassurance thing. I said, well, just watch it. What happens next? Yeah. What happens next? He thought it was, as I say, I think he thought it was more funny than anything else.
That's interesting. Mm. All right, then. So let's turn to the meanings and things then to end with. So we have from Spielberg himself, it doesn't say very much in terms of meanings, but apparently, according to somebody's, what's his name, Stephen Awolt's book, Steven Spielberg and Duel, there's a suggestion that he thinks of Duel as an indictment of the mechanization of life, and that David Mann is this everyman battling this machine that is like a sort of relentless, unreasoning aggression of a mechanical world.
Yeah.
I suppose that makes sense. Mm. And bullying is another thing that Spielberg talks about. Mm. The targeting of an individual for no clear reason, you know, the theme of vulnerability and powerlessness. Any other thoughts about possible ways of interpreting this?
Yeah, just the thing I was saying earlier about, we've talked about loss of masculinity, but also going beyond. And I think the speeding in the car is supposed to symbolise, you know, maybe he's a kind of a cautious guy, isn't he?
Mm.
You know, he's quite afraid of, I don't know whether you'd say he's afraid of things anymore than anyone else. But
How do people react to the ending? Is it good or bad that he's killed somebody? Is Spielberg saying he's got his masculinity back? Or is he saying he really shouldn't have been goaded?
It's self-defense.
Yeah, but why can't he just turn back? If he just turned round and went back home, he never does. He always goes forward, goes on, even though he's going into danger.
But wouldn't the truck just have turned round and followed in the other direction?
Well, who knows? He didn't try it once, did he?
No, he didn't try. That's true.
And I just think self-defense to a point, but it's almost like Spielberg is saying, great stuff, you're a man.
That's what now that you mention that, because he left his home at the beginning of the show. And his wife on the phone had told him he needs to be back home because his mother was coming over. So it makes me wonder where he was going.
Right. Well, no, I see it. We know there's a nod to the Westerns in there. So he's won the duel.
So that's a good thing, right? Or has he lost his humanity? Because he's become like the enemy. He's become like the beast that hunted him.
Yeah.
No, because I think it is ultimately self-defense, really.
Yeah. How is he getting home, I wonder? he's lost his car in the middle of the desert.
Did you get a point? Yeah. Was there any sense that he's relishing it? I didn't feel that at all. Was there anything in that?
There's a few points. Like there's one where he goes on that side road when the truck's kind of weaving in and out to prevent him from passing and tries to wave him on into the oncoming car.
Yeah.
He gets on that side road. And then like I think at that moment he sort of like, so, yeah, I'm winning. You know, like, sort of relish that part. And maybe at the end too, when he's finally free of the truck driver, he's like relieved. So I mean, like, I suppose at that moment he might be a little bit ecstatic, but not so much that he killed a guy. Just that he's like, oh, I'm free from this terrorizer. You know?
And plus, I think he'd gone beyond. Like we said, he found some inner resources almost.
Mm.
I didn't get too much of the sense that he was actually up for a fight to the death.
No, not really.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I don't sympathise with the truck driver at all, but I do with David Mann. I could completely believe myself. Okay, there are things, other decisions one might have taken, etc., in reality, but just taking the story as it is, I could see myself in that situation and acting out of self-defence and thinking, it's all over and I'm just totally relieved and jumping in the air like a child. Yeah, I can see that happening. I wouldn't have wanted to kill anybody, but in that situation, you defend yourself.
Yeah.
So presumably he'll go back. He'll eventually find his way back home somehow, go to that bloke who was, you know, making pass at his wife and then go and punch him in the face, won't he? And happy dory. That's the unwritten sort of, he's...
Well, only if you go for the sort of masculinity interpretation, but I think that's very much a subsidiary thing, if they're much at all, really.
Oh, his name is Man.
Yeah, as in...
Of all the 100 million names to choose from, David, which is the, you know, everybody's called David, Man.
As in every man, as in mankind, not as in toxic masculinity. That sounds like an interpretation added from a feminist aspect, which I don't think is there, really.
Well, not toxic
masculinity. If anything, the trucker represents the toxic masculinity.
Yeah,
indeed. Yes.
Well, I suppose he's finding his masculinity, whatever that means, that the David Mann character is just finding out how to behave as a man in the world.
Is he finding his masculinity or is he just finding something heroic about himself, which could be played by a woman, but it isn't?
you know, I do think the masculinity viewpoint is valid, but at the same time, it's like, I don't see anything about this that is specific to him being a man necessarily. Like a woman could have gone through the same thing, and she did in that Russell Crowe movie, apparently.
But, yeah, yeah.
I think you see it more as a character piece. You see him as this very timid guy who doesn't stand up to this, you know, his boss or whoever it was making a pass at his wife.
Yeah.
You see him, he's henpecked by his wife, and he's, you know, at the beginning of the movie, he's very much, he passes the truck, and then later the truck passes him again. He's like, okay, I'll just let it go. But then the truck slows down, and like, then it becomes the game. And then you see him as this movie unfolds, that he's like growing incrementally towards taking definitive action against somebody who's bullying him. So, I mean, it's as much about bullying and standing up to your bully as it is anything else, I would say, you know, and that doesn't have to be masculine in and of itself.
Yes.
But you can see his character arc from the start of the movie to the end. Is he had a full, complete arc of character growing in how he stands up to people. So now I see, yeah, like Mark said, at the end of this movie, if he gets back home, he's probably going to go clock the guy in the face.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Or maybe stand up to him in some other way.
Yeah. I think he'd be probably feels, well, I've done this, I can do anything now, you know?
Yeah.
He'd be like, man, I killed the guy in the desert, man. Just you might want to back off.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm actually really interested in what the aftermath of this movie would have been, because, like, he's got to get, where is he getting another car? Is there going to be insurance? How is he going to get out of this? I'm almost as intrigued about that as I am the rest of the movie.
Yeah. Rigging the
truth. Really. His court trial.
So that's what the sequel should have been about. Yeah.
The admin and the police investigation.
Yeah.
Well, why not? Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to just pursue this business about the human versus the machine thing. You know, the fragile human against the brute power of technology. I was just extrapolating from that and, you know, wonder whether there's anything we could take from this movie with respect to that. And I was thinking of the machine, obviously the truck, as the sort of the system with a big S, you know, the technocratic system that keeps coming, has not necessarily got your good at heart at all. You can't reason with it. You can't appeal to its better nature. It's just coming at you. And I was thinking that there are times when it will seem to pause if you sort of stop playing its games for a bit. Obviously, as stopping at the cafe, things pause for a while, but it's still working away, gaslighting you, and you know, it's apparently stopped, but it's still working away, and it's ready to put its foot back on the accelerator again. And then I was thinking that at the end of the film, we've said that David Mann overcomes this by tricking it. He exploits the aggression of the truck to its own destruction. I just wonder whether there is a lesson there. I don't mean this was intended by anybody, but could one get this from it? I do wonder sometimes that by, you know, not cooperating with the system, which often poses as reasonable and benevolent, etc., you know, we can actually sometimes push it to reveal its true colors, you know, that the state can reveal its authoritarian nature at times. If we peacefully resist it, if we disagree with what it's doing, we sort of force it to show its authoritarianism, therefore to reveal itself. I don't know, it's just something that chimed with me. Again, I'm not saying that's what the movie is saying.
I'm going to say, what sort of thing do you mean as an example of?
For example, if something unreasonable that the state might require you to do, and you stand your ground and you don't
unquestioning
do it, yeah, and the state then comes after you, whereas it previously posed as being completely reasonable and as tolerating dissent, let's say. You dissent and you suddenly find that actually it's not quite the free world and the democracy and all that a lot of people would think it to be. It reveals itself to be more authoritarian than one might suppose. And in some ways, I think that's a good thing for this to be revealed, you know. And I think we did see that during COVID. I know that's a while back now, but we did see that happening.
Yeah, I think the non-participation angle is interesting, isn't it? Because you can't completely non-participate, unfortunately.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people who are willingly participating that makes it much harder to resist them.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry to kind of change the subject slightly. It's just that you reminded me, Mark, when you were talking about the driver of the truck. I sometimes wonder whether the driver of the truck is a figment of David Mann's imagination. Because nobody else sees him. Is it in fact the truck that is the real antagonist in this, the real monster? But he just imagines there's a truck driver.
How do you mean? What, the truck or the driver? Or because obviously the school bus see the truck. I mean, lots of, you know.
They see the truck. We don't know whether they see the driver, though.
Right. I mean, I think we see too much of the driver, if I'm being honest.
Yes.
Early on, the camera sweeps around and you see him for a second or two. That, oh, okay, it's a bloke. It's a shame that you see a little too much.
Do you think it would be good not to have seen him at all?
Yeah, I think I would go along with your view then if you didn't see him at all. But I think you sort of see too much of him.
I had thought that you didn't see him at all through the movie the first time I saw it years ago. And then I watched it this time. I'm like, man, we do see a lot of this driver.
It is a lot.
Yeah.
I read, felt the same way. It would have been much more. Yeah.
Yeah. I read somewhere that it was you see his arm twice and you see his boots. But actually, you see a lot more than that, don't you?
Yeah.
Several times.
Yeah. This time I watched it, I saw way more of the driver. Yeah.
Going back to the appointment, we don't see the driver in the appointment of that lorry, do we, with the three dogs on?
No.
That was better, I think, to do that.
Yeah,
I think it was better in that regard. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to imply that this lorry dies at the end like a creature, then have it as a creature throughout.
Yeah, but then what did you say? Shot in 13 days? Did you say originally?
Yes.
It's extraordinary. Yes. I mean,
I know, it is
speed.
Incredible.
I mean, the amount of shots in that film, and I mean, watching it again, I think to make a film in 13 days is incredible. So I mean, to have the odd shot that you could have possibly gone back and changed or altered, you know. It's understandable, I think, in that sense.
Yeah. And also, instead of having storyboards, he drew out a big plan of the highway.
Right.
Then he wasn't worried if he shot out of sequence because he'd know, he'd sketched out what would happen in
that's
each
it.
Point.
Okay. Yeah.
That's right. And he hung it up on the walls of his motel room, didn't he? All the way around the walls. Yeah.
But, you know, Spielberg was hungry, wasn't he? And he was very economical and...
Yeah.
Efficient.
And apparently this was unusual for TV because a lot of TV is very close shots of people. And here it is very cinematic in conception with these wide shots. Mm. And that got him noticed.
Do you know when they released it in the cinema, whether they cropped it? Because obviously it's 4:3, it's a square shape for the TV. Do you know whether they went the full hog and cropped it for the cinema release?
Don't know anything like that.
Because that would have possibly spoiled some of the compositions.
Yeah, I don't know any of that technical nature now.
No, I just wondered because it's obviously shot for TV and you've got the talking about David Mann behind the laundrette, you know, window. That was perfectly framed for a television square. So,
yes,
you would have ruined that if you'd cropped it.
I feel like they would have gone for the widest possible, maybe.
Mm.
I think we may have done it.
Yeah.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, okay. Well, thanks very much, chaps, for discussing this, I think, great film. We call it a suspenseful triumph that showcases Spielberg's early mastery of visual storytelling. I've watched it a number of times and I never tire of watching it, and I think you see more and more in each time. That's certainly true for preparing for this, of course, because you're reading about it as well. But I mean, even if you're not, I think you just watching it again, you do pick up more and more from it. It's a very engaging movie and it's sort of like an eternal movie in some ways. So anyway, it's everywhere, so I wouldn't say where you're going to get it from, because you can just get it anywhere, can't you? It's so well known. So thanks very much, chaps, for discussing this, and it's a very good discussion.
Thank you. Thanks for having
thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jules.
Thank you. Show notes for this program can be found at The Mind Renewed, themindrenewed.com, podcast music by the brilliant Anthony Rajikov, attribution non-commercial, share alike 4.0 international. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, and my guests, Anthony Rotuno, Frank Johnson, and Mark Campbell. And I very much look forward to speaking to you again, God willing, and as time permits, in the not-too-distant future.